We have the opportunity to just kind of have a discussion here around the things that we're considering today and to react a little bit, ask Sean some questions and ask Ryan and Danny some questions, and to spend some time together. So just to kick us off here as we get going, why don't you each tell us a little about yourself? And tell us about your current role and what would have surprised you about what you're doing now 10 years ago. Lisa.
Yeah, my name is Sean. My current role, I'm the lead pastor of Glory Community Church, which is a church revitalization in Alabama. It was a Church of God church because God has a sense of humor. He sent me there to do a revitalization, and by his grace it worked. I would not have expected myself to be a pastor. We sold everything we owned and moved to the jungles of Peru to reach the Urarina people group, one of the few essentially uncontacted people. But due to a series of providential circumstances, I came back and ended up being a pastor, so I wouldn't have expected that. And I also wouldn't expect to be doing worship conferences because I'm not a music guy. But one of the things that I've found is that musicians and pastors need each other. And so I'm thankful that I get to speak into this from the pastoral perspective.
I'm Ryan. Good to see you all. This is my second time doing this, and it's so good to see a room full of people who are passionate about the Lord and passionate about serving Him in the church. I grew up in a Christian household. I gave my life to the Lord when I was about 15 or 16. It was that same summer I found a guitar in my grandpa's attic, and immediately I caught the bug of music and just invested in lessons. We didn't have YouTube back then, so it was all tablature and guitar magazine, but I wanted to plug into our youth group, and they didn't have a bass player. They had guitar, drums, singer, and I'm like, well, I want to get involved, so I guess I'll pick up the bass guitar. So that became kind of my instrument that I don't really have to think about too much more, but I started working at my current church about 12 years ago and started out as a worship leader for junior high school and college group, and then kind of moved up to conducting our orchestra, which was really neat because I got to use some of the compositional classes from my major and got to conduct in that way. And then in 2020, I moved towards becoming a pastor at our church. And I think what has surprised me the most is in the initial stages of leading music, it was all about the music, all about putting together the perfect arrangement and song. But as you become a leader, you have access into people's lives. So I think what surprised me is moving into more of a leadership shepherd role and people just coming up and going, hey, I'm struggling in my marriage. Can you listen to me? Or I'm struggling with this theological thought. Can we get coffee together? So music is still wonderful, but having access to people's lives and being able to share with them and just being a listening ear has been a beautiful burden, but it's something that the Lord is continually growing in me. So,
my name is Danny Bonsell, and as I mentioned earlier, I'm the minister of music here at Trinity Bible Church. My journey was actually into this type of ministry. I was raised in a Christian home. I was not a Christian through my high school years. As a teenager, I was playing already with union musicians. I was been able to do things that I thought for the rest of my life, this is what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be a professional musician. So I had the privilege of doing that and was not interested in the things of God. I didn't sing. Through a series of circumstances and events, just, you know, wonderful praying parents and everything, I'm just grateful to have found Christ, had my eyes open, and come to faith. I was still thinking, I was pursuing, you know, I was traveling full-time with the music group and thought that's what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life. And then through providence and God's plan and everything, it landed me in a church in Southern California and serving there, and didn't know what the future would hold, but lo and behold, here we are. I think it's going to be like 40 years of some type of music ministry and 30th year of worship leading. And what's surprising me is how much older I feel than what those numbers are. I mean, I feel just grateful for the privilege of that. And I would say when the question is what surprised now from 10 years ago, what has surprised us the most? Well, number one is how fast 10 years have gone. You're thinking 10 years, wasn't that just COVID, you know? But what 10 years has done, even in that, just thinking right now, every day I wake up thinking, man, I did not know what I thought I knew. And every day discovering just how much there is to keep learning about, not only, I wouldn't say just, you know, the craft of what we do, but learning about God and his depths, which challenges us in that. And so just this, knowing just how much more there is to go, right? So
that's so helpful and encouraging to all of us. That's why we're here, right, is to encourage one another as we learn and grow. So we have such a deep well here of experience. As you guys think about gathered worship, what burden sits on your heart the most? What sits prominently on your heart?
First of all, was there a memo that everyone up here should have an iPad? I've been a little naked up here without an iPad. Okay. For me, it's pretty simple. After Are We Singing What's True, it's congregational singing. The scripture is clear. The most prominent instrument on a Sunday morning should be the voice of your fellow church members. And so often I'll go into churches that are in many ways aligned on some of the things that we care most about. And then the singing will just be utterly non-existent, or it'll be performative, or something like that. So that's probably the first thing that comes onto my radar.
I think through if someone who isn't familiar with Christianity came in today to our meeting, would they get a grasp of what the gospel is? Would we be able to sing of the character and the nature of God? Would they get a sense of our grief over our sin and our need for a Savior? The assurance of pardon that we have in the cross? Would we have cross-centered songs that morning? And then would that lead us to a heart of thankfulness from Colossians 3, 16 through 17? So I'm thinking through that. I get to our church every morning about an hour before, and I pray for myself, I pray for our team, I pray for our church, and realizing that I have nothing to offer the Lord except for my sin. It's all I have to give him. But he has everything to give me in his son. So realizing, as unsure as I might be about an arrangement or what I might say, God through his spirit is going to work through the simple and meager means that we have to offer the Lord. And so I'm praying for confidence for our team, all the burdens that they're bringing. I'm thinking about the people coming into our room, that perhaps maybe that day may be the day of salvation, that the Lord would use a sermon, a song, something said, a prayer to bring about salvation in someone's life.
I alluded a little bit to this when we were talking yesterday, beginning of rehearsal, that the burden I have, why we invest and want to do something like this, I mean, it stems from just a personal burden even, is I just have a real desire seeing how when I started out, I didn't have a lot of good voices telling me, this is what you're supposed to be doing. Here's how you're supposed to do what you do, and you sort of follow the trends and do what everyone's doing. And my burden is that as I'm getting more on the other side, closer, I mean, I'm a grandparent now. I mean, all those things that you think, am I doing everything I can to be faithful to pass this baton and to see not only in our own church, the people being raised up, you know, I encourage a lot of our teenagers to attend this, is the people coming in around this area that, listen, we all are stewards of what we've been given and be able to learn this. Paul writes in 1 Timothy 3, it says, I hope to come to you soon, but I am writing these things to you so that if I delay, you may know how one ought to behave in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, a pillar and buttress of the truth. And that starts so much, that's starts where the music is being sung. And so I really want to, that's a burden of mine, is to see that passed on, right? I'm not going anywhere, and I don't, I mean, it sounds a little morbid, it's like my funeral here, but no, I mean, just, you know.
That was so helpful, that first session this morning. Thank you for bringing that to us and getting us started with the day. Out of Exodus, you talk about the Song of Redemption, Exodus 15. God gives us the narrative in Exodus 14. Talk about the significance of why he gives us both.
I don't want to be that guy, but that's kind of what I tried to do. I don't know that I can say anything more than what I said in the talk.
Okay. All right.
That's all I got. All right. I squeezed it all out into the manuscript, man.
Thank you.
So you can download the this morning's talk.
Get it in
we'll
the
go
book.
From there. There were some great things. I love just some great moments. You talked about how singing is good for our souls. I loved what you said about the importance of curation and paying attention to what we sing, and then the importance of singing the whole counsel of God. Ryan, as you think about your church's song diet and the whole counsel of God, what chapters of the redemptive story tend to be underrepresented?
Yeah, I think it's hard to find a lot of confession songs, a lot of lament songs. And I think on a very practical level, they're not in the top CCLI 100 song list, right? Those aren't the songs getting playlisted. They're not the songs that are big on Christian radio or have you listened to Christian music. So it takes a little bit more effort to try to find those, but it's necessary because it's part of our story, right? Before we get to the good news of the gospel, we have to remember the bad news, that we were straying, that we were far from the Lord. So it's why I appreciate kind of the wells that I love to draw from, like Sovereign Grace Music and City Light and Getty Music, who are writing for the gaps, right? They know what will play big in churches, which end up being kind of big celebration songs, resurrection, maybe even heaven, but they're writing for the gap. And so I appreciate that. And then I think just as Christians, we love to live in the resolution of our faith. We love to remember where the story ends. And I think sometimes it's helpful to backtrace and have that spot in our service where we need a song of confession, or it's a pastoral prayer of confession, something of that nature to fill out the gospel in our services.
You were saying about that, Danny? Yeah, anything to add to that?
I would just echo that having songs that are in the gaps like
yeah.
that,
you yeah.
know, that we need. I have a hard time finding a good congregationally friendly song that is like the Kyrie type of song,
yeah.
right? You know, so I sounded just what he said. I sound just like him.
One of the things in Sean's book, and he mentioned it this morning, talked about the artist and the engineer, and I think that's so poignant and so helpful to think in those categories, and certainly it's been my experience that those are the poles, both in congregation and in dealing with your people. Danny and Ryan, I'd love for you to talk about this too, coming from the musical perspective. What can we do as musicians to ensure that emotional expression is anchored to doctrinal clarity? Give us some practical help on that.
I think oftentimes we have a song and the words are really good. And so the burden for the musician is how do we get the music to add up to what the song is actually saying? So I think at least for our worship team, we're always thinking through, okay, what is the song doing? What is it saying? If the songwriter had enough intentionality to have verse 1 lead into verse 2, lead into verse 3, and the chorus is supposed to be this 10,000-foot view and doxology and praise based on what we sang in the verse, how can we musically describe that in a way that has a journey itself? And so oftentimes it's just reading through the lyrics of the songs and helping and allowing that to inform the choices that we make as musicians.
I like to always have between the songs, I do it a lot, is context to why we're singing it. And that is always a verse that gives the theme of what we're about to sing. And so as people say, you know, I love this song. It's my favorite. I love to sing it. And you can say, well, why is that? And well, I love the beat. I love what it does, right? So when you say, well, you know, the scripture here, and then here's how we put it to song. And so explaining things like that, and then removing things that distract. I think it goes the other way too, is like, okay, we're going to put like 4 key changes in this song, and we're going to do all of this stuff, and it's really going to bring out the emotional, but it's really, you know, not helpful. Now, I'm not against key change. My people are out there to go, Danny, you do key changes all the time. It's like, okay. I remember Bob Coughlin saying something one time. It was the first time I was at his church, and I heard like everybody just going crazy in the middle of the glories of Calvary, and I, you know, doing this right. And he explained, "We're doing this because of the lyric. Look at this lyric. He conquered sin, death, and the grave, and all of this." And you just look like, oh, it's okay to have that freedom to respond and be excited about what you're seeing, but rooted in in the context of the word, that is the bedding and the fuel for what we sing.
Yeah, Sean, you touched on that this morning about just being invested in understanding the redemption story on a weekly basis and allowing that to affect our hearts. On the flip side of it, how can we guard against reducing worship to instruction without affection?
I think I gave my best answer in my talk earlier. I think that's my answer, man. Focus on the gospel, meditate on it, sometimes right before you walk into service. I don't know that I have anything better to say. Y'all are going to regret having me on this panel.
Let's talk a little bit about the congregation and how we can, you know, lead more effectively. When the focus shifts from redeem people responding to God, what tends to hijack worship first in your experience? Is it artistry or is it engineering?
Can you read that one more time?
Yeah. So when the focus shifts from redeemed people responding to God, what tends to hijack worship? In other words, what distracts us more readily? Is it artistry or engineering in your experience?
Well, so you mean what, when the focus gets off of
that's right.
That.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I think when people are, they have their attention drawn to something other than singing. So it would be, I think gear and tech has been more affordable than ever before in the church. And so what that has led to is an over-professionalization of what a Sunday morning could look like. Just because we can do something doesn't always mean we should. And so I think it's having that in mind to go, how can we take out those elements that might distract people from just watching or participating? Some of that might be, for some of you, not doing a song in the same key that it was recorded in. You know, that could immediately take people out. Other means would be find moments in your service where it can just be your voices, right? So your songs are just a starting point in terms of the arrangement. But they weren't written to serve your church. They're written to serve a particular artist or a recording or a project. So use that. Use those good bones for your church, and you're not going to get in trouble. There's no legal problems with doing a chorus first or doing a verse first, doing it a cappella until the final chorus. Be creative in ways that communicate to your people that it's more than the instrumentation, it's more than the arrangement, and it's actually, like Sean said, highlighting and prioritizing the main voice of the morning, which is the congregation.
I think Sean said it well in his first talk. So that's all I'm going to say about that. No, okay. No.
You're learning well, brother. So,
I think getting the shift off of that, what happens first, artistry or engineering, I think that tends sometimes to be maybe the personality of the leadership that is making the decisions. And so it tends to gravitate where those people are. I mean, I've served under all types, some very pragmatic and very, you know, I don't care what song you see as long as the key that you choose fits in the budget, you know. Others, you know, are very, you know, we need a feel and, you know, this sort of approach with, you know, a cathartic sort of approach to the service or something. And you think, you know, I think it comes down to the shift is forgetting what our train tracks, I call them, is that we have, that train's going to go through different places, but we have tracks that guide us. That's what the scripture says. Here's what you should be doing when you gather. And there's things that every single biblical faithful church will do. Represented here are many styles and you know, all shapes and sizes. But if we call ourselves a faithful church biblically, there's going to be things that everyone says we have in common. So your service will be like, but this is exactly the same. Every faithful church should make it the goal in the morning when they meet that they read the word, pray the word, sing the word, preach the word, and see the word. And however that's done in your service and your culture and everything, it's going to look different. But that's there. So to not get off of what redeemed people are supposed to be doing, to move into this, too much of this, and, you know, we're going to do this, and those that's a great guide to help that this is what's something that's faithful, the elements of the service.
Listen to Sean's first session. Sean, talk about the role of the pastor in singing. If singing is word ministry, talk about how that shapes the responsibility of the pastor, and then also take it a step further and talk about what bearing that has on music leaders, because there's a lot of confusion about that as churches look for someone to fill that role. Is that a pastoral role? Should it be thought of in that dimension? Can you unpack that a little? I don't think you talked about that earlier.
So. No, I didn't. And little did you know, I was saving up all of it to answer this question.
Excellent, excellent.
Somebody set
excellent.
A timer to stop me if I can't stop myself. The most important thing you have to understand as a shepherd, and I guess as a music leader, about your shepherd in relation to yourself, is that at the end of the day, your pastor has to give an account for all the word ministry of the church, and that's a very weighty thing. So let me just get very practical. What this means is that if you are in a church and you're a music leader and you feel like you should have the final say of the songs that are sung on Sunday morning, you've fundamentally misunderstood how authority flows in the church. There is a sense, of course, that those who lead in singing as worship have to give an account for that ministry. We all have to give an account for every ministry that God has given us. But when the entire congregation is gathered together on a Sunday morning to sing the word, to pray the word, to hear the word read aloud, to see the word in the ordinances of baptism and the Lord's Supper, the person who is most responsible for that are the pastors of that church, which means that they should be leading and guiding and shaping your Sunday morning worship, including the singing. Now, that's going to express itself in any number of different ways. And I imagine that even just between us, who are very like-minded on this subject, it probably looks even different in our churches. So here's how it works in our church. At Glory Community Church, we want the main point of the text to be the main theme of the service. Whatever God is trying to tell us in 1 Corinthians 14 or Acts 6 or Exodus 12, whatever that core idea of that text is, we want us, our congregation, to pray about that in our prayers of praise, confession, lament, pastoral prayer. We want us to sing about that. Now, sometimes the theme of the text is hard to find a song for, but you do the best you can with what you got. Romans 11, is there a song about the engrafting of Gentiles into the Jews? Maybe there is, but we don't know one. Okay, but that's the general idea. And so what I'll do is I'll meet with my associate pastor and my music guy on a Tuesday morning, and I'll give him a rundown of the text, insert office quote. I'll give him you got that rundown? Yeah, I got the rundown. And I'll say, here's what I'm seeing in the text. And then I'll send them an outline of our order of service, which is basically the same, trying to have the flow of the gospel. And then they'll populate it. They'll choose the song, the verses for call to repentance, assurance of pardon, call to worship, benediction, scripture reading. My music guy will choose the songs that we're going to sing. And then we'll meet back in my office on a Thursday and we'll go through it together. Now, I could imagine a scenario, and I don't have to imagine, it happens very often, where the music guy might say, here are the songs. And then if I say, well, brother, actually, I don't think that third song works. He might say, well, I'm the music guy. Well, that's true. You are going to lead us in song on Sunday morning. And your input does matter. And I care. I want us to have a conversation. But brother, at the end of the day, you're here to serve me and my pastoral responsibility as I construct worship and prepare us for it on a Sunday morning. And he understands that. And we work really well together because when it comes to music, like y'all are talking about key changes, I'm over here thinking about locks and doors. I don't know what anybody... And he's so patient with me. I'm using melody when I should be talking about something else. But we talk about it. And I try to do my best to speak in music. He does his best to speak theologically. And we work together to fashion the best service we can on a Sunday morning. Now, that's my long answer to the first half of the question. What was the second half?
Well, I mean, I think you answered both there. But it's essentially the relation and, you know, how to think about music leaders. You know, how should a church think about that?
Yeah, there is some theological significance to a person who is a music leader. In the Old Testament, the Levites had singers in the temple. So I do think there's a place to have a pastor whose primary oversight is singing and that part of worship. Yeah. I don't like... what's your title?
Pastor of Corporate Worship.
What's your title?
It depends on about what you're about to say.
Well, yeah. Well, never mind.
Minister of Music.
Sean, I appreciate what you're saying, because I know of friends and colleagues who are worship directors and leaders at their church, and they're like, well, my pastor gave me 15 minutes, so I'm just going to choose my three songs. And there's no sort of discipleship between what happens, the opportunity is missed, where a pastor can go, okay, here's the text that we're going through, here's the main point, here's where we want to land, and what an opportunity to have collaboration within a team. It's so invaluable.
It doesn't even have to be theological. So, for example, the hymn of response. Well, if I've worked with my music guy and I've told him how I'm going to land the plane in my sermon, then he'll go, well, hey, I know that you really want to do this song, but it feels like even like maybe not even theologically, but emotionally, we can do better if we do this song. Or I'll say, well, what about this song for a call to assurance or a song of assurance afterwards? And he'll say, tonally, I don't think that works. He's just so helpful. So it's like a husband and a wife. You know, in the home, a husband may have the authority, but he's at his best when he's really leaning into his wife and her strengths and her understanding of the way the home works. That's how I feel with my music guy. Is that funny? Oh, because he's my wife? He's like my work wife? Yeah.
I need to take an opportunity to say, in no way, shape, or form do I think that Manny Pereira here is my wife.
No, he would be your work husband.
Wait.
You would be the work wife.
What are we doing?
This is getting worse.
I don't know who y'all brought in last year to do this, but maybe bring him back next year.
I don't think we're going to be allowed to do this again.
Let's close in prayer.
Yeah. I just got to say, I mean, this may be helpful, people like how to practically do these things, but I appreciate what I have here. I served one time under a pastor who just decided whenever he wanted, you'd plan the service and he would just get up and decide, I'm just going to do something completely different. And he would grab the mic and completely sing. And now you're going like, what church was that where Danny used to be? It was years ago. And that's not the way to do it. You know, you sort of lose, you know, but even then I was still learning, like, how do you plan, how do you put it together? But now I appreciate here we weekly meet, and I tell Manny, I can't do this unless we talk about what we're doing, and he gets that, and so we do this, but he's super passionate about what we do. I'll show him a song and he's never heard it, and he'll go, y'all know, that's awesome, yes, and I think that's kind of the response you'd like to see, you know, when you plan things. But where I spend most of our discussion is I ask him to literally let me know if you can give me the best case where you think you're going to bring, especially a difficult passage that doesn't have a low-hanging fruit of application. You're going, how are you taking this and leaving the congregation at the end of your message? It's because we share this philosophy here. This is what we think here. I, as a music minister, can completely undo your many hours of teaching that you've prepared this week. I can undo it in 4 minutes of a song by doing something that has nothing to do with what you said, or change the context of what you had just brought. And so that song takes on the context of whatever he's preaching. And so you want to pick that correctly so that people are, that's the closing application is enforced and solidified by what we respond to as a congregation. And he's really into that. And I know, I'll give him a say, here's three possibilities. And he'll go, okay, that's a good one. That's good. I don't think he likes that one. What about this one? Oh, that's good too. All right, how about these lyrics? Oh, yes! So I generally know that's the closing song we're going to use. Am I getting this? Am I speaking in hyperbole? No, it's right. Okay. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, no, it is helpful. If theology leads to doxology, that's the model that should be in our churches as well, right? And if music is an extension of the pulpit, the effects of that are profound, not just in the ministry to the congregation, but to everyone who's involved, whether you're on the platform as a musician or you're sitting out here, participating in the worship service. I've been in both environments where music is an extension of the pulpit, and the difference in the ministry that takes place when that is in place and the ministry that takes place where music is thought of as sort of a third-party function is profound. It's a profound difference. Ryan, as you think through and you curate your church's songs, what makes a song worthy of shaping your church 5 years from now?
That's a great question. I think as I look kind of over a year's worth of new songs, we try not to do too many new songs. We do about maybe four or five a year. I'm thinking through, can this song be sung around a deathbed? Could this be sung as mother's rocking her child? Can this song help a struggling saint who is suffering in the room? I'm thinking through the singability of a song. Is a song so dependent upon the arrangement that you try to do it a cappella and it just doesn't work? So does it have enough melodic and lyrical integrity for it to stand on its own? I appreciate City Light, and I once talked to Johnny Robinson, and I said, what's your model for songs that you guys do? And he said, well, we often disappoint people because their songs are so simple, but the average church size in Australia is about 50 people. So we want our songs being sung around bonfires and living rooms. And if you want to make it bigger and do that, that's great. But we're writing for this specific purpose, that it could be done anywhere. So now I'll say that there sometimes are songs for a specific season. So if we're going through a sermon series and there's a song that just fits so well, we might teach that, knowing that maybe 10 years down the line, we don't use it in the same way again. But for that moment in the church, in our church life, it was helpful.
Danny, what would you say makes a song congregational? And how important, let me talk about this a little bit, how important is the idea of beauty in our curation?
I prefer Sean DeMars. Think through. Okay. No, I'm trying to think through without getting a lot of technical. So I used to be an expert at this. I used to think that's congregational. That one's not congregational friendly. And then you put something before and it just totally, like, they can't get it. It totally flops, right? And then you think, okay, that's not. And then you put it out. Well, it's a test. Let's see how they sing this one. And it's a banger. And man, the place is just going nuts. Like, how in the world? And I'm thinking, okay, some of the most difficult songs that we sing are congregationally friendly. And Can It Be is a huge example. If I were to drop a brand new song that you wrote and you get it there and it has those intervals, if people don't know, I mean, you guys know And Can It Be? I would say, we're going to learn a new song, and it goes like this. Da da dee da 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 da. I sing hopefully not as bad as that. That's to prove a point. My point is, I'm thinking, what is it that makes that congregationally friendly? Like, how's that such, you pull that out. It's like an It Is Well song around here where the people just go crazy on that. And so to strip it down to, like, what makes it friendly is, okay, it's going to have these kind of melody line. It's going to have this. I think it first starts with obviously that content that says this is accessible by everyone, starting there. Because you can have a great song that someone hears, or they say, hey, can we do this song? And you look and you go, you know, that's a real personal testimony. That's not something that I think is going to work for the entire congregation to sing, because it has such a, you know, I can give an example, but I don't want to offend anybody. But, you know, there's like, you know, okay, I will. I just think of a song, and I remember when it was really popular, you know, the pastor I was serving at the time said, hey, could we do, you know, The Heart of Worship? I love that song. And I explained to him, I said, you know, it's a good song, good to listen to, but that's a real personal testimony of what this person was going through. And you look at this first verse, and I'm not sure that really applies. You know, we want to focus on things that are common to everybody here, you know, the big picture of God and the gospel and all of these things. And we only have limited time. And so you look at that. So I think we're looking for things that start with that commonality that makes it congregational. And then as a musician, you need to be trained enough and have a wise, you know, approach that says, you know, not of them can be And Can It Be. So they're going to, you know, look in a song like Come Behold the Wondrous Mystery is the most simplest melody line. And I remember Matt Boswell saying, he says, I'm sorry, I wrote this thing kind of like City Light. He's like, it's the dumbest melody. When you hear it just by yourself, it's just, it's like three notes, right? And you marry that to the content and everything, and the congregation grasps that and can sing deep things because of how simple and accessible it is. And then you're training your congregation to learn in the beauty. The next part is how important is artistry. You don't want to just do boring stuff. It has to have a melodic approach, the chord structures, everything that you do with design and care to bring that emotion properly and let people engage with the poetry of the songs. Whether people are musical or not, they're wired to respond to the musical bedding of the thing. So you have to be wise. It's pretty subjective. I'll have to do a seminar on that someday.
Does that help?
Yeah, that's very helpful. Sean, you talked a little bit in your first session, I am going to bring that up, about leaders, the importance of leaders and elders singing, and you used the example of the guy in your church who wasn't singing. How should we approach that? I mean, I assume that implies that we should think of whether you sing or not as a definition of spiritual maturity. So, you know, we've all dealt with, I'm thinking of a guy right now who often I will be leading and look out, and he's just sitting there with the arms folded, and he's just looking at us the entire time. So talk about how do you approach somebody in that situation, and, you know, how do you talk to somebody about that, and what is the goal there? What's the approach? Talk about that a little bit.
So I can approach people who struggle with this from a place of gentleness and patience, because I used to be the guy who didn't sing. I remember when I first got saved, I had gone to church before I became a Christian, and I did not like any of it. Whenever I would get invited to go to church, I would go, and I didn't enjoy any of it, but the song, the singing in particular. You know, they'd open up the hymnal, and they'd be like, "We're going to do all five verses," and I'd be like, "Oh, help me." And then after I got saved, I still struggled with it. So that's the first thing, is it's easy for me to be gentle and patient because I was that guy. But let's go back. Why did I struggle with singing? So there are a number of reasons why people may struggle with singing. Let's just walk through some of them. First is they maybe have never been discipled to see the importance of singing. They don't understand that it's part of what God put them here on this earth to do, to glorify his name by uniting their voices with the voice of all the other saints. So I'm talking about somebody who seems to love the scriptures, who seems to want to obey Jesus, who wants to glorify God with his life and his doctrine. So maybe he just needs you to tell him that, you know, hey, look at this. Now, with that guy that I tried it with, it didn't work. Another reason why, and that you're going to get those too, by the way. You guys know this. You can show somebody in the Bible and it still doesn't matter, okay? Another reason why some men may struggle to sing, and I'm sure this is not the case in your church, but in many churches it is because the music has become so feminized. Because the church has become so feminized. You know, this is a crisis in American evangelicalism. We are bleeding men. So one of the ways that you can help men learn how to sing is by, because honestly, I've not seen this to be a problem with women. I'm sure that they're out there, but I think they're the exception that proves the rule. If there's going to be someone standing in the meeting hall on a Sunday morning, stony-faced while we sing, it's probably going to be a man. And there is some legitimate reason why he may struggle to do that. If he grew up in the 80s and the 90s in, you know, your average build-a-box, squishy, evangelical, seeker-sensitive church, he's just maybe never seen masculine worship, not just from the stage, but also in the congregation. We can stand up here all day and say this and that and the third, but, you know, sometimes you just need to experience it for yourself. I can tell you when this happened for me. The first time I went to T4G, do y'all remember that, Together for the Gospel? We miss you, T4G. I was so excited to hear John Piper preach. I couldn't believe it. I was like, I want to get to hear John Piper preach. And I had a buddy on the way there. He was like, yeah, but the singing, right? And I was like, whatever. I guess. If you say so, get a load of this guy, right? The singing. John MacArthur's going to be there, you know, like. And this was in the days when it was in the arena and it was a bowl. 10,000 men, some women, but 10,000 men, many of them pastors. The first song that they sang was "In Christ Alone." 10 seconds in, I was even thinking about it. I was undone. And I was like, this is what heaven is going to be like, right? So C.S. Lewis talks about this. He says, you can try to tell someone about a planet, or you can take them to that planet and let them breathe in the atmosphere. So one of the things that I did to fix the lack of male singing at my church was whenever we did anything that was just men, we sang. And of course, we taught on it. You know, I made an application point in sermons. I would bring it up on Wednesday nights. I had a special issues meeting with our elders to make sure that we were all on the same page about it. And it took us about 4 years, cutting bad songs that were hard for the congregation to sing, trying to introduce more masculine songs. Have you guys heard of the song, "The Son of God Goes Forth to War"? Who's heard it? Raise your hand if you've heard of it. All right, let's go. Shout out to you guys. How do you know about that song? Okay. Okay, well, talk to me afterwards, because I have a version of it that sounds like when armies march off to war. The melody so perfectly matches the lyrics. Even things like that help. So just like there's no such thing as a monocausal explanation, there's also no such thing as a monocausal solution. You got to do a bunch of different things to try to get everyone moving in the same direction. I was rambling there. I'm sorry.
No, it's very helpful. Yeah, very helpful. The discipleship implications are substantial in music ministry. Ryan, unpack that a little bit and talk about just the connection between music ministry and discipleship and the community of the church at large.
Yeah, have you ever been praying with someone and they start in their prayer using lyrics of the songs that you're singing? Part of discipleship is giving your church the language of their prayers. They will often pull from the songs that they sing because it has the most repetition. Sermons are powerful and they have sticking power. But like Sean said, the character of music, its properties, it sticks with you longer. And we want to give people the right language to pray to their God to, and the right language to pray about the God, or to speak about the gospel with. Also say that just discipleship amongst a team of a worship team, it's almost like you have a job to do that Sunday morning, and it's a glorious job, but that becomes an excuse to hang out and live life in community with one another. So the aim is we want to serve our people, but we're also growing together in gospel community with one another. So I'm able to know those in my group better as we set aside time in rehearsal, yes, to practice music, but also to pray together and to get to know one another better. So it becomes just a great landing spot for community.
That's great. I love what you were talking about, you know, moving slowly. Four years, you said it took. I mean, I think that's so wise in turning the ship slowly. Danny, as you think through congregational singing, what are some things that we're doing or can be prone to doing that undermine congregational worship? Because I think, and just as you're thinking about that, one of the things that I mentioned, the 4 years are kind of the slow, you know, turning the ship slowly, and the wisdom of that is that I honestly think a lot of times people don't sing because they just don't understand, you know, they haven't been shepherded well. And I think we're doing that unintentionally often. You know, we're not being explicit about helping people in that direction from the pulpit, let alone interpersonally. And so it becomes, you know, checking off the boxes when you come to church on a Sunday morning. It's like, you know, you sort of categorize everything. So what are some things that you can help us with there that we might be doing unintentionally to undermine congregational singing?
You mean like just...
I mean, whatever you want to say, Danny. You just jump in there, bud.
What was the question?
What things are we doing on a Sunday that may undermine congregational singing or the understanding of it?
I think that when it comes down to when you're planning that service and the people that you're with again, right, it starts there too, where they may not have a clear idea again of what it is that we're supposed to be doing. So and what undermines that is when we are you have only so many minutes in that budget of the time. And you say, hey, we really need to put this in the service. And we say, does that really belong there, right? And so the important thing is
is getting the congregation to understand why they're there, what's the purpose of it, and that dispels even a lot of like the personal preferences that people will battle over and say, you know, how come we're not doing this and we do that. Is over and over and over, we want to educate them and keep telling them this is why we're doing this. Take every moment between songs, you know. So the good intentions of this has to be done. Our congregation needs this. So I try to help. Like a lot of times, maybe there's a different way we can think about doing that and protect the liturgy of the service so that we're focused on what we're supposed to be doing. And fortunately, around with good people that want to understand that, right? So I guess that's the way we're going to undermine it. It's kind of the previous question we had is not a clear idea of what it is we're supposed to be doing.
May I answer that as well? Two things that are very simple, sound and light. What undermines congregational singing? If the music volume that's coming from the stage is so loud that I can't hear myself sing, I'm not going to be able to hear anybody else sing. They're not going to be able to hear me sing. And I think you guys know this. When you hear other people sing, you automatically sing louder. Here's the proof. You're in a Sunday morning service. They're playing the music. They go a cappella for a verse. The music drops out. 5 seconds in, what happens? Everybody sings louder, right? So volume is a big thing. And then lighting is a big thing. I think this is a pretty happy medium. I'm like, some people like low lights in their homes. We have like, ours looks like a surgery center. It's just, it's as bright as it can. But this is a good happy medium. I don't walk in here going, oh, I'm at a concert venue. But if you have the lighting in the meeting hall set up in such a way that all of the light in the room is concentrated on the stage, that communicates something to your people. These are the professionals, right? This is a concert. You're here to observe, not to participate. When the scriptures tell us, sing psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs to one another, if I can't hear you, I can't fulfill that command. If I can't see you, I can't really fulfill that command. Now, I understand some churches, even just architecturally, the way that they're arranged, it's kind of difficult. But like in our church, I regularly look around and see other saints looking at me and other Christians as they're singing to one another. So lighting and sound are two really big ones.
Can I add one more thing? I think attached to that, when people are looking at those who are singing on the stage, if they're closing their eyes, it's communicating that kind of hermetically sealed idea. So, but if they're actively engaged and they're looking at you and they're making eye contact, it's communicating that we're doing something wonderful together. I can have my own private time of worship on my own in my car, but we have this unique 75 minutes that we get to be all together as one body. And let's enjoy it together.
Can I say one more thing? I hope you, yeah, we're just going to keep going back and forth. I interviewed a very famous musician recently who has now transitioned to being the worship pastor of his church. And he didn't know kind of how persnickety I can be about congregational singing. It didn't come up. And we were just talking about the hymns we love. And he said, oh, Come Thou Fount, I heard you love that hymn. It's one of my favorites. And I'm like, oh, yes, soulmate kind of thing. And he says, you got to hear this version I led my church in. It's in 4-4. I don't know what that means, right? So I'm like, cool, right? He turns it on, impossible to sing. It's so complex. I don't even know if that has to do with 4-4. I don't even know what that, again, I don't know what that means. But he had so many vocal runs. And the way the music stuff was syncopated with his voice, I just thought, and by the way, he showed me the live version. All I heard was his voice. I didn't hear the congregation. And I thought, if I were in that room trying to worship with this, I couldn't do it. I literally couldn't do it. Maybe if I was like a trained singer. But regardless of how badly I sing, Come Thou Fount is a very easy song to sing as far as the tune goes, right? So one of the things also that gets in the way is complexity. And that's a problem because a lot of the people who serve in the music stuff on stage, in their mind, complexity is attached to beauty, right? The beauty is in the complexity. And I just want to say it's kind of the opposite. I often think that beauty is in the simplicity. It's where the painter doesn't paint. And on a Sunday morning where the painter, the musician, doesn't paint is exactly where room is going to be left for the congregation to add color. Yeah.
I'm going to add one more thing. I also think another place where it's undermined is the example that's set forth by the leadership. Okay, you were talking about on stage. I mean, think about that. You have your eyes closed. It demonstrates something, right? But how it undermines congregational singing is if we're trying to tell people this is important, it's a command, you must be doing it, but the leaders tend to be engaging in something else while the singing's going on. You know,
are you talking about like the pastors?
Pastors, elders.
Yeah, people in the church who are leaders.
Yes.
Yeah, I've seen
that. Yeah, because they're going to look at that and they're going to go, oh, well, that's how they value it. That's communicating without saying any words. You know, I heard one time years ago, I was mentioning something about how we're opening the service and trying to do this, and one of the elders says, well, I'm never ever in there at the beginning. I'm busy. I'm you know, I love meeting people outside, you know, and I'm thinking, shouldn't you be saying the service is starting? Let's go in, right? Or the pastor that sits in the front row looking at their notes while you're singing or not coming out at all until it's his turn to speak. I'm not calling him out. He doesn't do that.
Okay.
Just so you know. Okay.
Thank you for your example, Manny. Yeah. Thank you. It's wonderful.
Yeah, no, it's for real. I mean, he's the first guy up there singing and going, and one time we left his mic on, and we know where his gift lies. Oh, I got to tell you this story. One time we started this good service, and we started, and they forgot to take him out of my ears. And so I have this real gentle moment with the soul. We're singing this kind of opening thing, getting before the congregational part. And Manny's singing along with me like he's right here singing right there. So we're going to talk about that at the technical breakout later. All right. I know we got off tangent right there. So,
No, really helpful. Can we thank our panelists here? Yeah. Grateful for wisdom and encouragement. I'm going to ask Sean to close us in prayer, and then we'll transition to the next.
Father God, you know that the things we are discussing are massive. This is what you have saved us for. This is what you've called us to. Our primary job is to extol the glories of your name. This is one of the ways that we draw the lost to ourselves, as we burn bright with the flame of true worship. And we know that your word tells us how we ought to worship. And we also know that there's much that can be gained just by simple prudence. And so we pray that you'll help us to carefully consider not just your word, especially your word, but also the wisdom that others have to offer. Lord, give us a vision for worship that clearly aligns with your vision. And then let us just trust that you'll do with that what you may. So many churches think that they have to do music a certain way, or the church won't grow, or the church will shrink. But Lord, if the church is faithful, you'll take care of everything else. So help us to be maximally faithful for the good of your people and for the glory of your name. Amen.